This morning, the court has three causes on oral submission. In the order in which they will be argued, they are as follows. Mary Camacho versus Leo Samaniego, Sheriff of El Paso County, from El Paso County. Sage Streets Associates and Others versus Northdale Construction Company and Others from Harris County. And James E. Elbauer, M.D. versus Carol Mercer Smith from Tarrant County. In the first two causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. In the final cause, the court has allotted 25 minutes. The petitioner may reserve a specified portion of time for rebuttal. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each cause and will complete these arguments before its lunch break. The arguments are being recorded for the convenience of counsel of the court. If anyone desires to listen to tapes of these arguments, please contact the clerk of our court. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in the first cause.
In the court, Ms. Susan Larson and Stuart Forbes set argument for petitioners. Ms. Larson will open. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Susan Larson, and I represent the petitioners Camacho, Merrill, and Apodaca in this appeal. I had intended to address the jurisdictional issues before the court, and Mr. Forbes will address the merits. If you have questions on the merits, I would suggest that you wait for him, because he is better prepared to answer those questions than I. This is a case dealing with an $18 bail bond fee that is charged by the Sheriff of El Paso County every time a bail bond company gives bail for a criminal defendant. The plaintiffs are all licensed bonding companies, and I would note that the Sheriff does not charge a fee for PR bonds, personal recognizance bonds, or for cash bonds. These are fees that are charged only where a bail bond surety is involved in a case. Back in 83, the sheriff began charging a $2 bail bond fee, which was approved by the El Paso County Bail Bond Board. The county commissioners never approved the initial fee. However, in 1986, the county commissioners increased the fee to $5, in 87 to $10, in 88 to $18, and the fee stands at $18 at this time. There's a order from the county commissioners that the $18 fees be placed in escrow ever since the filing of this lawsuit. That is just a brief background. The case has an odd procedural posture. It was initially filed in County Court at Law Number 2 by the plaintiff Marilyn Camacho. Then Mr. Forbes and Mr. Christensen, on behalf of the plaintiffs Timmons, De La Chica, and others, filed a similar lawsuit, which fell in the district court, the 210th district court, also in El Paso County. The remaining plaintiffs intervened in the case following a transfer from the 210th district court, consolidating that case, the De La Chica Timmons case, with the original case in County Court Number 2. This is important because the Court of Appeals in El Paso found that there was no subject matter jurisdiction in County Court Number 2, and therefore that the entire proceeding was void. They vacated the judgment of County Court Number 2 and dismissed the cause of action as to all plaintiffs, including the people that had filed in County Court Number 2 originally, the people that had filed in the district court originally, and all interveners. The subject matter jurisdiction question in this case is one that has been heard by the Court of Appeals in El Paso before in a case dealing with the bail bond board. This is the McCarter case, which is cited in the brief. This whole problem arises because El Paso has a unique system. We have almost completely concurrent jurisdiction of the district courts and the county courts at law in El Paso. There are only a few exceptions where the county courts at law cannot hear any case filed, civil case filed in the county. Those are felonies, misdemeanors involving official misconduct, and cases involving the supervisory control of the county commissioners. Formerly, appeals from orders of the county commissioners were also exempted from county court concurrent jurisdiction, but that language was deleted in 1989 by act of the legislature. Also in 1989, same amendments, the legislature passed Government Code Section 25.0732T. That is the procedural device which was found unconstitutional by the Court of Appeals. And I would also point out to the Court that this is the Court of Appeals opinion is unpublished. It's an opinion holding a statute unconstitutional, which they have elected not to publish as presidential, case. In any event,
I think we've ordered that opinion published.
I don't believe they have. In any event, what T does is simply assign any case in which a county court of law would not have jurisdiction to the local administrative judge, the presiding judge. In our case, it would be the 205th District Court, automatically. It is deemed filed in the first instance with the local administrative judge, and the county court of law judge who actually hears the case is deemed assigned to the district court.
I take it that changes over time, that one judge, the local administrative judge, changes from time to time.
Yes, it does. And at this point, to the best of my knowledge, it's the 205th District Court, Judge Cowan.
The lawsuit is filed with the district clerk, who's also the county clerk. And how mechanically is that assignment made? By computer random assignment or rotation?
It's a random assignment. That's correct, Your Honor. Everybody who has a civil case goes up to the same counter and hands their lawsuit, their original petition, to the same clerk. And the clerk assigns all cases in number in order. It doesn't matter whether it's assigned to a county court or a district court. They all get a number that the first two digits are the year. And these would be 92-001-002. And it wouldn't matter whether it was a county court at law or a district court. We don't have anything so sophisticated as a computer-generated assignment. We have little wooden disks that have numbers on them, and they're in a box or a drawer, and the clerk just draws one out. And if a lawyer comes to the clerk with a case and says, I have to have this filed in a certain court, the clerk is reluctant to comply because they, probably with some justification, believe that the only reason a lawyer would want the case assigned to a certain court is because it would be forum shopping. And there really is no simple way to get a case such as this that when it was filed, it may or may not have been. Nobody was really certain what the nature of the case was. If you look at the original petition in the record that was filed by Camacho and Merrill, you see that the district clerk has written damages on it. They ask you when you file a suit, what kind of case is this, so they can put it on the cover. And logically enough, the lawyer said, this is a suit for damages for an unauthorized fee collected by the sheriff. There is nothing that would have clued the clerk in that this is something that could not be filed in a county court at law.
I noticed that some of the precedent that some lawyers cited on the substance of this issue came out of the Court of Criminal Appeals. Under what circumstances would that court get questions about fees the sheriff charges?
On the fees the sheriff charges, is that the State versus Sellers case that you're referring to? I'm not sure what the judge is referring to.
I'll figure it out. I'll read the case.
In any event, the subsection T was passed by the legislature as simply a procedural device for correcting problems in what is basically a good system that works well for our concurrent jurisdiction and which occasionally falls apart when a case like this, which is very unusual and for which no real precedent would tell the district clerk or for that matter, the lawyers, where it had to be filed, it resolves those questions. It is not, as the Court of Appeals would urge and has found, it is not a usurpation of the judicial function by the legislature. In fact, it acknowledges the jurisdiction of the district court, the exclusive jurisdiction in these cases.
The trial court specifically found that it had jurisdiction. Is that correct?
The trial court found it had jurisdiction, and in fact, all parties are in agreement that the county court at law had jurisdiction.
To what extent was that issue tried in the trial court?
The trial court requested briefs on the issue from all parties. The trial court raised that issue sua sponte.
Was evidence taken?
There was no evidence taken. However, it's simply a matter of law. It was briefed, and the briefs are in the record. And the trial court did find that it had subject matter jurisdiction. I'd just point out a couple of other things to the court. The Court of Appeals finds that the legislature did not have the authority to create this procedural remedy for the county court at law. However, if the legislature had the authority to grant concurrent jurisdiction in the first place, with certain exceptions, I would submit that it certainly had the authority to create this procedural remedy for a problem that arose following the use of the system for a period of time.
Does the Court of Appeals holding call into question another 1989 legislative act that permits administrative judges to assign county court at law judges to a district court?
No, it does not address that. And
what would their logic call that into question?
I would say that the fact that a county court at law judge heard the case is of no moment to the Court of Appeals.
It's merely what court it actually...
The only thing that the Court of Appeals is looking at in both the McCarter case and this case is what caption appears at the top of the case. And in fact, if you read the McCarter case, you'll see that the case was heard and decided by a district court judge from the beginning, and the fact that it was had a county court at law caption was what was fatal in that case. So I would submit that the Court of Appeals is saying that it matters not at all who's actually assigned to the case and who actually hears the case, whether or not it's the county court at law judge assigned to the district court or not. Finally, on the issue of whether this is an appeal or a direct attack on the supervisory control of the commissioner's court, I would point out that the petitions in this case all cite Local Government Code 81.041, that they complied with the requirements therein. They submitted their request for reimbursement of the fee to the county commissioners. They requested a hearing before the county commissioner's court before they filed the suit. I would submit that under those facts, this case can be construed as an appeal of a county commissioner's order, negative or positive, and that therefore, following the amendment in 1989, the county court at law would clearly have jurisdiction of the case. And finally, just as a practical matter, I would point out to the court that if subsection T is unconstitutional, it creates terrible problems and absurd results. This case is a perfect example of that. Because the case was originally filed in a county court by some plaintiffs, originally filed in a district court by others, transferred by the district court, apparently believing it had jurisdiction, to a county court, heard by a county court, there's no way that a plaintiff can ensure it gets into the right court. If you file it in...
Counsel, excuse me, I believe your light came on to the signal for you. The counsel came in getting kind of antsy. How much time do we have left, counsel? 2 minutes.
Actually, Your Honor, I just wanted to introduce myself.
And I think that's probably about all the time I have left. I did want to speak to the merits. I did want to answer the original question. The fees in criminal cases are set by 103.1
103.002 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, which provides, and I'll just briefly read it, an officer may not impose a cost for a service not performed or for a service for which a cost is not expressly provided by law. And that's in the Code of Criminal Procedure. This entire case evolves out of a criminal proceeding. An individual is arrested. He's taken to the jail. He's booked into the county jail. Then the sheriff releases the individual on a bail bond. The bail bond is criminal in nature. The history, the legislative history, is what we've discussed in our brief. It goes all the way back to 1937 up to the present. The most important thing is the discussion between Saffarini, Senator Saffarini, and Senator Washington, which we put in our brief. Let me make a reference real quick to our plaintiff's Timmons amended motion for summary judgment, which is at the transcript, page 338. And that's a legislative history of where we talk about what the senators were discussing. And what in effect happened was, is after Jim Maddox wrote the opinion of JM 80 in 1988, which held that Article 3926 little a, which is now 118.131 of the Civil Practice or of the Government Code, that's the article we're going under, if it applies to criminal cases, it's unconstitutional. So the legislature had a real problem. They wanted to give county commissioners the authority to set fees of services of constables. But what they did in 1981 is they removed the laundry list. And they just gave them a general statute, which applied only to civil cases, which you have to go back to 1937 to look at the caption of the case, which stated right then and there, it applies to civil matters only. Anyway, getting back to 1989, the legislature said, look, in order to give the county commissioners the authority to set fees in criminal cases, we have to go back to the voters, ask for a constitutional amendment to give the legislature the authority to then let the county commissioners set fees in criminal cases. In the Senate session, SB 356 was the bill, and then there was a joint resolution to attempt to get a constitutional amendment, which had failed, and I think my time just ran out.
Anybody have any questions? If you did have three more minutes, what would you say?
Well, I'd like to thank my mother. This is criminal. It's criminal, and it's criminal. 3926 little a is civil. It doesn't make any difference whether you label it as administrative remedy or administrative fee or any situation. And to be a little nonsensical is what I would probably say if I had three more minutes. A sheriff could charge a fee for emergency response. They could charge an administrative fee for an information fee. A safety patrolling fee, a crime prevention fee, a crime response fee, a jail visitation fee. I mean, these are services that the sheriff performs. They're not listed. They're nonsensical. If every time someone wanted to go to the county jail, they could charge a fee to get in. If the sheriff was responding to a call of a robbery, they could pick up the telephone and say, excuse me, do you have your $25 fee? I'm sorry, we're not going to arrest this individual who's robbing your store unless you pay the fee. This is a service that we provide, and the county commissioners have set this fee. The case of Stringer versus Franklin County, which I've cited in my original brief, and it's at 123 Southwick 7, 1168 to page 1171. When the law has fixed the compensation which an officer shall receive for given services, or when it has imposed upon him the duty of performing services without specifically fixing any compensation, therefore, he cannot contract to receive from other sources any additional compensation for doing his official duty. This is official duty of the sheriff. He is obligated to release the defendant. There is no privity between a bonding company. A bonding company is not a party to a lawsuit. is between the state of Texas and the defendant. It's as if you would go to the bank and the bank would require a co-signer to pay a fee before he would loan money to the principal.
Any other questions? Thank you, Bill. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Okay, please, the court, Mr. Eddie Martin will present argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Eddie Martin. I'm an assistant county attorney from El Paso County, Texas, and I'm responding for Leo Tomaniego, sheriff of El Paso County and the county of El Paso. As you know, this is really about whether what is now section 118.131 of the local government code allows the county to set a fee for the sheriff to collect on when he does services for the bail bond company, when he takes a bond, when they present a bond for a defendant. This bond has been set not only in El Paso but in several other places, which is why this case is of such importance. I think if you look at section 118.131 and the amendment that was made in 1981, it's clear that the changes that the legislature intended were twofold. One was to continue the practice of allowing the county to receive the cost for the sheriff doing certain actions which benefited private individuals for their own private benefit or for either pecuniary or otherwise, like filing fee for filing a lawsuit for a district clerk in the sheriff's case, in issuing in serving processes, receiving bonds, and of that nature. The second effect of the 1981 amendment was that they took out the laundry list of things which they said the sheriff could charge for. And I think this was done in particular effect because the main reason was is that the duties of the sheriff expanded, the things that the sheriff did, which was costing the taxpayers money and which he had to serve, which was just the benefit of private individuals, were increasing. And therefore, the legislature took away this laundry list in order to allow the local governments to figure out what was the things were that needed to be charged for in order to compensate the taxpayers for the fact that the sheriff was doing these actions which essentially compensated private individuals.
So you're arguing now that under current law, as you understand it, the sheriff can in fact charge fees that are authorized by the county commissioner's court for an arrest?
No, sir. That is not, I mean, these are not an arrest, public safety actions, the things of which the sheriff does.
How about for a visit to the jail? Visit an inmate?
No, I don't believe that.
Well, why not?
Because those are the normal duties of a public safety and the functions of a jail.
Isn't releasing a prisoner that is supposed to bond a ministerial duty that the sheriff performs?
We're not charging for the release of the prisoner. We're charging the bail bond company a fee for the administrative functions that we do, that we have to do for them in order for them to present a bond for a defendant.
How does that differ from visiting an inmate in jail?
An inmate in jail has the right to have visitors. That's a constitutional right.
Does the defendant have a right to be released from jail after you post bond?
This fee does not prevent him from posting bond.
You're missing the point. The services provided by the sheriff are the same, are they not? In either instance, whether it's letting a family member visit the prisoner or letting the family member effectuate the release of a defendant after posting bond, the services provided by the sheriff are the same. And yet in one instance you say the fee is authorized by law, and the other one you say it's not. Help me understand the difference.
Because essentially, when you let someone visit in the jail, they're not getting a pecuniary or any other kind of gain from visiting. That's just they're visiting someone which they have a right to visit. A bail bond company does not come to the jail in order to visit the individual. He comes there to make profits. He gets there to do certain things in order to make money.
Why isn't there a fee charged for PR or cash bonds?
There are fees charged for those, but as cash bonds, there's a specific fee set for that already. PR bonds, there's a specific fee set for that.
What is the dollar amount of those fees?
I think for a cash bond, it's $5 or $10, and the PR bond is up to $20, depending on what the judge does on that. And there's specific reasons why there's differences between cash bonds and PR bonds, because there are different things which you have to do for those particular things, which I think substantiate the differences in what the fees are.
And the nature of the paperwork? Or
nature of the paperwork, the amount of people involved to do it. As you know, under a cash bond, a person just comes in with whatever the amount of money is, that's it. You take the money, the bond's posted, that's it. A PR bond, it has to be determined by a magistrate or a judge that the person is entitled to be out on PR. And there, in El Paso County, that is run by the probation department.
And is there any limit to the amount of the fee that the county can charge?
The limit is set by the statute itself, which says that the fee cannot go over the reasonable cost, the cost involved.
If the commissioner's court set that at $50 or $100, then there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, it would have to be justified by the what the costs are, the actual cost. It can't exceed that.
Article 103.003 in the Criminal Procedure Code states that an officer cannot impose a charge except as authorized by law. Is that true?
Yes, sir.
Your view of that, except as authorized by law, includes commissioner's court order?
Yes, sir.
If so, why doesn't that allow the commissioner's court to charge fees for virtually any service rendered by any officer in the county?
Because the statute is specific. 118.131 is specific. It says it's only for the services of the sheriff.
But the commissioner's court could exceed that.
No, I mean,
under your reading of 103.00.
No, the commissioner's court only has the authority to set this fee because 118.131 allows them to. The commissioner's court on its own doesn't have the authority to set a fee.
So if the attorney general is correct that 118 of the local government code is civil only, then you lose.
Well, the thing is, I don't think, if you look at the JM 880, I don't think that's exactly what it says in essence. JM 880, it uses a general term of criminal cases and civil. But if you look at 880 and look at the reason why they said that it could not apply to criminal cases was because of constitutional defects. Because the code of criminal procedure, those costs are assessed as punishment. And JM 880 and the reason of JM 880 said the reason why it could not apply to criminal cases was because of constitutional defects, because you would be an unequal punishment throughout the state of Texas if those were the change. And those fees are not being changed. They are not changed by the county of El Paso. No one has alleged that any convicted defendant in El Paso County was charged a higher fee than what those are entitled to by statute. So I think you have to look at the reason of the case, not just a conclusionary statement which they made at the end of their opinion. If you look at the reasoning of JM 880 and why they said that it could not apply to criminal cases, that reasoning does not apply to the fee that says here, that is set here.
I take it you agree with the petitioners that the trial court had jurisdiction.
Yes, sir. Although originally at the trial court, when I looked at it, I had overlooked that particular provision of T, but I do agree at this time because also to correct one thing that happened that was said before. In El Paso County, the county courts have concurrent jurisdiction with the district courts, but the district courts do not have concurrent jurisdiction with the county courts. So the county clerk and the district clerks are not together, as one of the questions asked about whether the county clerk and the district clerk are in the same place. In El Paso County, they are not in the same place. County courts still have exclusive jurisdiction of things such as FED cases. They still have exclusive jurisdiction of all appeals from justice of the peace courts and of that nature. But the problem is that because of the nature of the jurisdiction on civil cases, and having concurrent jurisdiction in both the county and the district courts, it would almost make the district clerk have to read every lawsuit and read it and to make some kind of legal conclusion to make sure that this wasn't one of the cases which might need to be in a county court or a district court, and I think that's why this procedural system was instituted in El Paso. So I do agree with the reasoning of the petitioners as far as the jurisdictional question, because it would come out to a ridiculous result when you're asking a district clerk or a deputy to read a case and to determine what the nature of the lawsuit is. And the fact is, that would be no guarantee that they would correctly determine the nature of that lawsuit anyway, especially in light of all of the statutory authority now, which puts county court law judges and district judges to sit on the bench for each other.
What would be wrong with the system where the lawyers made the choice of which court a case was filed in, and then if there was an error, at least the party, it could be charged not to a deputy clerk, but to the agent of the party that made the mistake.
Well, the thing is, that would be all right in some instances, I guess, but the thing is, some questions are close. I think this is a close question about which would be the proper court here in this particular instance. There's arguments both ways. In my original brief, since I had overlooked the previous provision of T, I had argued that it was a county court case and that it should be determined by the county court of law. But as I did that, it's a close question about whether this is something that's exclusively within the county court jurisdiction, I think. And then you get to the point where you're having to make a decision about whether you're going to take a chance of trying the case and then having to try it over again.
Since the Court of Appeals decided the jurisdictional issue, it did not reach the merits of the lawfulness of the charge, why shouldn't this case be remanded to that court to review those issues?
The thing is, unlike some of the cases which were cited by the petitioners, this case, if you say that it was properly in a district court at the time, they transferred the case. There was a proper transfer order which distinguished the case they cited. And it also, and of course, there was only one of the parties actually did that. Only one of the parties were actually in a district court. All the other people had been originally in the county court of law, and all the interveners came in after the case was in the county court of law on that particular, on that issue.
But why should this court address the merits of the charge in the first instance rather than referring it back to the Court of Appeals to address those issues?
Well, I think this court could probably do both. I think since most of the issues are a matter of law, I think that this court has the authority to go ahead and make a decision based on something that is a matter of law. As far as I think this court also has the discretion to go ahead and send it back if they would want to, for the Court of Appeals to decide on the merits. I would just briefly like to go over just a couple of the things that there was a reply brief that was filed, and I did not ask for a response, so I'd just like to go over a couple of instances where they some of the things which they alleged there. The petitioner in the reply brief on page 7 and 8 said that the respondents had alleged that they had not challenged the reasonableness of this fee. If that's the impression I gave, that is not what I intended. When I said the petitioners, in this particular case, all parties had filed summary judgment motions and cross-summary judgment motions. And what I meant by what I said in the statement of fact is that in the summary judgment motions, the reasonableness of the fee as pertaining to the statute 118, which says that the fee cannot exceed the actual cost involved, no one had challenged that. in their summary judgments at that particular time. And that's what I meant by that. I did not mean that they had not challenged that the fact that the fee was not reasonable as far as being allowed to be authorized. But I was just talking about the fact that everyone has filed summary judgment motions down below. And in their summary judgment motions, none of them had attacked the reasonableness of that fee as related to the cost involved. There was also, they had mentioned in their reply brief, on page 18 of their reply brief, as pertaining to Article 3909, which is the extortion statute, which the petitioners are alleging they're entitled to four times the fees that was charged. Okay. And they seem to imply that I was alleging some kind of good faith immunity. I think my brief is clear that what I was citing is a case which said that an officer should not be punished for the fact that they relied on good faith on statutes that had not been declared invalid or unconstitutional at the time they relied on. And also, I would also argue that kind of interpretation would lead to the result that officers like district clerks, sheriffs would be trying to, they would be all filing lawsuits when any new statute come about, trying to figure out whether they should first file a lawsuit and get a judicial ruling before they undertook any new endeavor enacted by statute. So, for the reasons that I think that stated on the record and in the briefs of this cause, the petitioners would ask that the judgment of the trial court would be affirmed on this particular case.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. The question of why should the case not be remanded, why should the court hear this case, regardless of the decision of the Court of Appeals, the briefs, the matters will not be briefed any differently. The arguments will be the same. The facts will not change. And if either side is dissatisfied with the ruling, either side will be asking this court to rehear the matter. The case itself involves well over $1 million of posting fees since 1983, and I'm sure that if the court decides that the dollar amount or that the law is with the appellant, the county is not going to lay down under these circumstances, especially when the appellant is a practical matter of asked for fourfold. But be that as it may, the for judicial economy, the facts are not, we have an agreed set of facts. The facts are not going to change. The parties, the law as they argue it, and that would be the real compelling reason that I see, that we're going to be asking this court to review it again. And it involves a lot of dollars. The going back to...
Do you know how many other counties have...
Well, I know Houston. I know that Dallas has stopped. I know that Ector County has stopped. I think that Belton County continues to do it, or Belton, Texas.
If Houston continues to charge these fees?
They want to. They're under an injunction not to. There's
Harris County.
Harris County, that's correct. They're under injunction not to. They want to. One of the things that the legislature said is, you know, a giving the commissioner's court the authority to set the fee would have a different fee in El Paso, a different fee in Harris County, a different fee in Ector County. These are equal protection and due process arguments that are involved in criminal cases. The entire argument is kind of cyclical. Does commissioner court have subject matter jurisdiction to enter an order to allow a sheriff to collect a fee? When we originally brought this suit, appellants Timmons and De La Chica and the interveners behind, as represented by myself and Mr. Christensen, we were attacking an activity of the sheriff. Because if you look at the orders of the commissioner's court, they do not specify who is to collect the fee, what kind of a fee it is, from whom, and at what specific time the fee is to be collected. What happened was is the bail bond board itself
decided in 1983 that a fee was going to be collected. The sheriff, who was Mike Davis at the time, went out and collected a $2 fee. Then Sheriff Samaniego decided to raise the fee. And at all the time, the county commissioners then approved a raising of the, quote, bail bond fee. Never said who was to collect the fee from. Never said what it was for. The important thing is that an $18 fee, if the bail bond companies do not pay the fee, even though the bail bond company have given the bond to the sheriff and the principal has signed, and by the way, it's important, under the Code of Criminal Procedure, the defendant is the one that gives bail, not the bonding company. The sheriff receives it from the defendant. But in any event, if that is done, the sheriff says, oh, you can't get, even though, Mr. Defendant, you've done everything you're supposed to, you can't get out of jail until we receive an $18 fee from this bonding company.
Up front.
Up front. Cash. Because they won't accept checks. And they don't give coupon books either. It has to be cash. There is no bail bond fee on PR bonds because PR bonds are controlled by statute. Can
a district judge charge assess a fee though for a personal recognizance bond?
Only pursuant to the statute, which used to be 2372P-2, which is now in the Code of Criminal Procedure. The district judge can waive it, and I believe it's up to a $20 fee. But it's in the Code of Criminal Procedure. There is no fee specified for cash bonds, cash bail bonds. I mean, this is a fee that is charged to someone that is not in the system. There is no specific authorization for charging this fee. All fees under the Code of Criminal Procedure are to be paid upon conviction.
Any other questions? That concludes the argument. Mr. Paul, the court will now take a brief recess.